May it please the court, Frank Patterson, registration 12058, on behalf of the defendant and appellant, Shelter Mutual Insurance Company. The legal issues here involve the tension between the rights of two insurers that were co-primary defending a person in an underlying bodily injury suit. I think our briefs adequately explain our position on the legal issues on equitable subrogation or equitable contribution. I'll talk or argue more about those in a moment, but first let me just go to the real common sense and practical way I believe this should be resolved or should have been resolved before, both by Farmers in the underlying litigation and then by the trial court in its opinion. Mr. Fritz was the driver of the vehicle. Because he was driving his son's vehicle, he had the good fortune to have two insurance policies that protected him. One was his own, and then one on the vehicle that he was driving. Both of those policies were primary. They were co-primary. They each owed him upfront obligations to defend and indemnify. Because they were co-primary, though, they both shared the expenses of the defense in the underlying case, and they would have, if there were a verdict or judgment, shared in that judgment. As is customary, both policies had a provision in it, that said that the carrier had the right to decide or control settlement. So each of these companies, Shelter and Farmers, had an equal right to decide whether to settle or not settle the case or go to trial. And that's where the tension comes in. In this case, one of the carriers decided it wanted to settle. The other carrier thought it had a completely defensible case and wanted to defend the case through trial. If you look at it through Shelter's perspective, Shelter says, look, we have a contractual right to control settlement and decide to defend the case if we want. Farmers is trying to buy this unilateral settlement. Farmers is taking away our right to control settlement and take this to trial. I acknowledge you look at it from Farmer's perspective, they're saying the same thing in reverse. We have the right to control settlement, and we think the case should be settled. Shelter, by insisting on a trial, you're taking away our right to settle the case. So these appear to be equal but conflicting rights, and how do we resolve that? I think Colorado law already is in place that tells us how this should have been resolved. In a situation like this, if Farmers had an opportunity to settle the case and wanted to settle the case, as it did, and it went to Shelter and it said, Shelter, we want to settle for $75,000, and Shelter said no, Farmers said, okay, we are no longer responsible for anything over the $75,000. If you take this to trial against our wishes, Shelter, you now become responsible. If you're the one that wants to roll the dice, if you're the one that wants to take the chance, you, Shelter, now become responsible for anything that may happen adversely. Conversely, if they get a defense verdict as Shelter anticipated, Farmers would have reaped the benefit of that. But Farmers would have been in no worse position whatsoever than if the settlement had been concluded at that time. And that's exactly what the law is right now if there were only one insurer and the insured. Remember, Farmers in an equitable subrogation situation really is stepping into the shoes of the insured to go after Shelter here. But let's take Farmers out of the equation. There is law in place right now. If the insured had said to Shelter, look, you're my only insurance company. I think that $75,000 offer is good. It's within my policy limits. I want to be protected. Shelter, I'm asking you to settle the case. I know, Shelter, that you have the contractual right to control settlement here. I don't have to say so. I can't force you to do it. Shelter takes it and goes to trial, and if there's a good verdict, great. But if there's an adverse verdict and it goes over the policy limit, what's the law? Shelter is responsible for it. Even though the policy limits may have been less than the verdict, Shelter becomes responsible to pay that verdict for
it. What case is that you're relying on? You say we have Colorado law already saying that. What case is that?
Well, it goes back to the 1960s with the, I believe it's Greenberg case. It was the initiation of bad faith. We had, at the same time as the Basher case, now, this is not a Basher settlement, but it's a comparable claim where the adverse verdict was in excess of policy limits. The insured ask the carrier then, and make the carrier become responsible for the excess verdict. And basically, the decision said, and I can't call it to mind at the moment, and I can submit the citation to the court as a supplemental if the court requests, but I believe it's from 1967, and the carrier became responsible for the excess verdict.
Was this theory argued in the trial court and or in your briefs?
No, it never came up at all. There was no argument in the trial court. It just submitted on briefs, and it did not get argued at all in the briefs.
Or on the briefs in front of us now?
Well, not specifically. It does arise out of, though, the arguments both on equitable contribution and equitable subrogation, which is that farmers, as the person stepping into the shoes of the insured, has no more rights than the insured would have had. If you look at the Avis versus Allstate case, which Farmers relies upon, I don't think it helps us at all. All it says is that the two of you are co-primary. The Texas case relied upon by the trial court does not help us at all because it dealt with an excess and primary carrier. Well, the Texas case that we cited is more on point because it deals with two co-primary insurers.
And you've talked about the half where, okay, we've assessed the risk and somebody insists on going to trial anyway, who's going to be responsible for the the excess? What about the other half where, okay, someone insists on where you settle it essentially against the insurer's advice?
And I'm not following you. If the insured settles it against the insurer's advice?
Well, if the insured settles it against the insurer's advice to place them in the position of the insured.
Let's take Farmers out of the situation again. We just have the insurer and his insurer. And the insured goes to the insurer and says, boy, I really like this settlement proposal. I want you to take it. Shelter says, no, we control the right to decide whether to settle the case or not. The insured says, well, I'm going to go ahead and pay it myself then, just because I fear the risk. Contractually, the insured cannot recover that from the insurance company. That's a breach of the contract. So that the insured does not have the right to recover that settlement from the insurer if he unilaterally pays. That's in the contract itself. Now, I believe Colorado law would now, as it's being stretched over the past decade, would allow a question of reasonableness. If the insurer had basically abdicated its responsibilities, and that's what all the National Casualty versus Great Southwest and all the cases cited by Farmers in this case, one insurer is completely denied defense and indemnity. Not like we have here, which is Shelter providing defense and promising to pay indemnity.
Why isn't it still just a fact question about reasonableness if one wants to settle and the other one doesn't? Isn't that just a question as to which one's position is more reasonable?
It's my suggestion you don't go that far because then you end up with fights between insurance companies all the time. It's much cleaner to follow the system that we have in place now, which is if you are co-primary and you can agree on settlement, great. If you can agree on trial, great. If you cannot agree and one of them wants to settle and the other doesn't, you don't unilaterally settle, but you protect your interests. In the situation I'm describing, Farmers is completely and totally protected. If it had a solid offer to settle and it said we want to accept it and Shelter turned it down, then you don't even need to get to the reasonableness of whether Shelter should or should not have. If the trial goes adverse, Shelter becomes responsible for the excess.
So the question then is, okay, that's your suggested process would be make more sense. But what do we do in the case where, okay, Farmers decides, no, we're going to settle the case? Is the answer like you get bupkis from us?
Yes, and that's where we get back to the law on equitable subrogation or equitable contribution. You go through the five elements of equitable subrogation and Farmers fails in at least two or three of those. This is a voluntary payment. That's why in the primary versus excess carrier, it's presumed that when an excess carrier has to step up because the other one has totally abdicated its responsibility, it's presumed that it was an involuntary payment. Farmers in this case has submitted no evidence that its payment was anything other than voluntary. The one thing that it submitted to the court that the trial court latched onto was that there was a risk. And I submit to the court that every litigated case contains risk. You cannot say that a settlement of a litigated case, by definition, is involuntary. This was a business decision by farmers. There was a complete lack of submitted evidence to the trial court as to anything to support involuntariness on the part of farmers. We heard nothing from a farmer's representative that I thought we were going to lose big. We heard nothing, even in the letters that were submitted from the trial counsel, that they thought they were going to lose. It was merely an estimate of what might happen at the upper end. That doesn't mean that it's an involuntary payment because you have a risk of an excess.
Okay, putting equitable subrogation aside and looking at equitable contribution, is voluntariness even an element of that theory?
Of equitable contribution?
Correct.
And an equitable contribution setting, they're both usually co-primary.
Which is what we have here.
Right. And again, what's the question?
Well, whether voluntariness is an element of equitable contribution. As I understand, equitable contribution is just did they pay their fair share or not?
Right. No, I think equitable contribution does not require that. Again, in the case cited, National Casualty versus Great Southwest, it's where one carrier did not participate at all, so the other one was forced to pay the other side's share. And in the Texas case that we cited to you, when they were co-primary, it said that one that overpaid its portion has no right either of equitable contribution or equitable subrogation. So it doesn't really matter. I think the answer to your question is no, it doesn't matter. I'll reserve the rest of my time, unless you have a question, Rick.
I do have a question, but I'd like to stop the clock at this point for a second. We'll give you a couple more minutes as well, counsel. Excuse me. My question is, under equitable contribution, fair share of the liability, is liability in this instance determined by, well, what was the likelihood that there was going to be a judgment, as well as the likelihood about the size of that judgment, to which perhaps expert witnesses could have been helpful?
Well, those are questions of reasonableness. And that, again, is a lack of evidence in the record as to whether Shelter was unreasonable. The only thing the court could have inferred that Shelter was unreasonable was the possibility of an excess verdict. In those letters from the trial counsel, it estimated the exposure up to $170,000, and I think the maximum insurance was $125,000. But there was no evidence submitted from anybody at Shelter as to what they thought the potential was for an excess verdict, and there was no evidence from farmers as to what they thought the potential was. Just looking at the underlying facts, though, I think all of us recognize that the potential for a defense verdict was significant on liability in the underlying case because the vehicle had the right of way, the vehicle was not speeding, the vehicle was mostly past the little boy when he ran out. Everybody assumes that he didn't realize there was a trailer behind it and just bolted out behind it.
So we have to have a trial on reasonableness?
Well, no, I don't believe so. We've submitted our request here is for summary judgment in favor of Shelter, that this court send back with instructions to enter summary judgment because this was a voluntary payment that farmers did not need to make. It could have protected its interests otherwise, but by making the payment over Shelter's desire to go to trial, farmers did so voluntarily and cannot claim equitable subrogation.
Thank you, counsel. Would you add 2 minutes to opposing counsel's time, please? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Todd Myers, registration number 14799, on behalf of Farmers Insurance Exchange, and I apologize for the head cold. No, Your Honor, reasonableness is not a requirement of contribution. That's one of our points. And no, Your Honor, a trial is not needed on reasonableness of whether the $75,000 payment was reasonable. Because that's not an element. That's not one of the five elements of equitable subrogation. The trial court did not err in granting equitable subrogation for Farmers Insurance Exchange for $37,000, which is half of the $75,000 paid to to settle the Trammell lawsuit. In that lawsuit, the attorneys, and remember that Farmers and Shelter both hired the same law firm to defend them, gave the opinion within 2 weeks before trial that there's a possibility of a verdict between $144,000, $142,000, $177,000, which is above the policy limits and probably above the policy limits of both Shelter Insurance and Farmers Insurance. So the five elements of equitable subrogation were met. The first element and the fourth were admitted by Shelter, that Farmers is a subrogee. It made payment to protect its own interests. It did so to avoid an excess verdict or the possibility of excess
so
verdict.
So it was a voluntary business decision?
No. Not voluntary in the sense that most people consider voluntary. Voluntary in this sense is a legal term of art, and it has to do with the relationship of the parties. And so, jump ahead on voluntariness, the important thing to consider when we consider voluntariness is that the court found that Farmers was not a voluntary payee because it risked too much. It risked an excess verdict. It was also told specifically by its attorneys that there was a probability of a verdict above its policy limits. And it did not fit the definition of under Black's Law Dictionary of volunteer.
Where in the record is that the risk, the probability of a verdict in excess of his policy limits?
That's the second page of the opinion letter by the law firm Hawes, Harrington and Light that were hired by Farmers Insurance and Shelter to defend the Trammell lawsuit,
of course,
to defend Roy Prince.
There's also the other side, though, that Shelter thought that they had good defenses on liability. And so if that's true, then there would have been no excess verdict.
If there was a straight defense verdict, yes. The Farmers thought that there was likely that there would not be a defense verdict, that there would be a substantial verdict against it.
Doesn't that just mean, though, that the parties have some issue of fact as to whether or not settlement was reasonable or not?
Yeah.
I know you're saying it's not an element, but it just seems like one side saying it was reasonable and one side saying it wasn't.
Yes.
And those are business decisions.
In a sense, Your Honor, it's a business decision. In the other sense, it's not because they're compelled to make the decision, but they're not an intermeddler. They're not intruding into the affairs of another. Farmers Insurance has a quasi-fiduciary responsibility to its insurer, Roy Fritz, or Bill Fritz, to protect his rights and to defend him. And so they're looking out for his rights as well as the possibility that they could have paid more or they could have paid over the policy limits, and they settled a case for $75,000, less than the policy limits. And they, by doing so, they released Shelter's liability, they release their own liability, and they release the liability of Bill Fritz.
You could have said to Shelter, well, if you want to take it to trial, go for it. You assume the risk.
I think the decision made to settle was within a few days of trial. There's nothing in the record that suggests that there was any discussion about that. That is far. Shelter, will you agree in writing that if we take it to trial, that she'll pay anything over $75,000. There's nothing to write about that. That's something they could have decided, but they didn't. So we believe all the elements of equitable subrogation have been met, especially the volunteer statement, volunteer element, that Farmers was not a volunteer in this legal sense, and the other element is that Farmers was not primarily liable for the debt. It's been admitted that Farmers and Shelter were co-primary on this case. They agreed to share the expenses. And so the analysis would then be under Allstate versus Avis of the apportionment that the parties would share.
Let me ask you this. Isn't there another element about it's not unjust to impose that?
Yeah, that's the fifth element.
And so why is it not unjust to impose the effect of a unilateral decision upon someone else.
The trial court said it would prevent unfair distribution of losses among the insurers. So, I mean, that's the best argument, is that why should farmers have to pay X amount of dollars and Shelter nothing?
Farmers agreed to do it. How about that? Shelter didn't.
Well, but they agreed, but they weren't a volunteer. They had an interest to protect. They had their insurance interest to protect, and they also discharged the Shelter's obligations by settling the case for $75,000. And Shelter would get a windfall if it walked away from not having to contribute to anything of the $75,000 settlement. Now, let me just quickly address, if I may, the contribution argument. The court did not analyze the case under contribution analysis. If it had, the requirement of reasonableness, voluntariness would not have to be dealt with. In the case of, we cited National Casualty versus Great Southwest, National and Great Southwest were co-primary for the same loss, that is the wrongful discharge of the police officer. National Casualty insured the city of Craig. Great Southwest insured the officers under an officer's liability policy of the police officers in the city. The Supreme Court adopted the majority view that National was entitled to pro rata contribution from Great Southwest for its defense costs and settlement payments. That's a quote. Also, contribution was allowed in the case, Colorado case Safeco versus Westport, 2007, the appellate court case that dealt with the old PIP statute.
In both these cases, was the other insurer non-participating? It wasn't a participating one.
Yes,
case.
In National case, Great Southwest, also Hartford Insurance was involved. Neither Great Southwest nor Hartford participated. They said, we don't have insurance coverage. Well, it's not even a question of us coming and offering to pay defense costs. We just don't think there's any coverage here, and so you do what you want to do, National, and come after us in a deck action if you want to.
So you think that doesn't make a difference when there's a participating insurer and in the cases where there's a non-participating?
No.
And why is that?
Well, what Farmers did, what Shelter did participate in is in the settlement.
Correct.
Is in the indemnification, or is the release of liability.
But in the other cases, they didn't participate in the defense at all.
That's true.
And that's not a significant difference between those cases and the facts. That
I don't see it as significant at all. I see the end result is that the fact that that an insurance company does or does not participate in the underlying lawsuit doesn't have a bearing on whether it can be required to contribute under contribution theory. I'd like to just spend a few minutes on the step-down coverage. After summary judgment was granted, the Shelter in 4 days, 5 days, filed a motion to reconsider. Then the notice of appeal was filed by 4 days later on June 11th, the trial court granting the motion to reconsider. Motion to reconsider is a motion for a new trial. In this case, it reduced the judgment for Farmers from $37,500, that is half of $75,000 settlement, to $25,000 minimum statutory liability under the Colorado Insurance Financial Responsibility Law. We believe the trial court should have denied the motion to reconsider under the Zolman versus Peer case because the first element of the three-part test is not met for a motion to reconsider, that is, new evidence.
Is the motion for reconsideration really up on appeal? If it was decided after the notice of appeal has been filed, the court didn't have jurisdiction to enter that order anyway, did it? So instead, tell us why the $37,500 judgment should be defensible.
Okay.
Didn't it have jurisdiction to enter that order? Granting a motion for reconsideration. I think opposing counsel even agrees it didn't. I think that's why opposing counsel is presenting that as an issue.
I wasn't sure, Your Honor. I thought that it still retained jurisdiction even though this even the order was issued 4 days after the notice of appeal filed.
Okay, let me ask you, how about, let's go to the merits of it. Let's not talk about the standards necessarily, but the merits of it. Why should 37,500 be the number instead of 25,000? How's that?
Because it's half of the $75,000 payment, and the apportionment is under Allstate versus Avis Rent-A-Car case. When parties are co-insurers, co-primary, they share dollar for dollar up to the exhaustion of one of the policy limits.
But I thought there was a step-down provision that limited Shelter's exposure to 25,000.
That's right.
So why isn't that provision applicable?
Two reasons. It wasn't. The court should have denied the motion for new trial because it was evidence that Shelter could have raised. Look, trial court judge, we have a $25,000 step down provision. Why are we even talking about $37,000? The most we can possibly be liable for is $25,000. That was raised after summary judgment was entered in the motion for reconsideration. The second point is the case of Shelter Insurance versus Mid-Century, Colorado Supreme Court case 2011, which dealt with the identical drop-down policy. Here's the interesting point. Mid-Century Insurance Company, in that case, Mid-Century is a division of Farmers Insurance Group. So almost essentially the same parties. The Supreme Court found the drop-down clause unenforceable because there wasn't proper notice given to the insurer. The notice was absolutely no notice, essentially, whatsoever. It would require, in that case, for the insurer to actually read the entire insurance policy, the renewal policy against the first policy, and determine the step-down provision in there. I did it. It took me 10 minutes to find it. It would also require the insurer to know the minimum financial responsibility laws under the Colorado statute. So the court said, no, that drop-down provision is void unless, and these cases are 3 years apart, Shelter's case on appeal in Shelter versus Mid-Century and our case, they're 3 years apart. But there wasn't any evidence in the motion for consideration addressing this issue whether Shelter gave proper notice when it renewed Mr. Fritz's coverage on his Mercedes-Benz. So, that's our argument, is that procedurally, the motion consideration should have been denied because this is evidence of the drop-down clause that Shelter could have discovered. And even if it did, there would have to be a hearing or proof at the trial court level that this notice was appropriate and given, and that it notified Mr. Fritz that his coverage, if he was driving, if there was a non-insured involved, a non-permissive user involved, that coverage would be dropped down from the declaration limits here, 50,000, 100,000, to half that, 25,000, 50. So, Your Honor, we request that the court grant the affirm the granting of the motion for summary judgment for $35,000 and either invalidate the motion to consider, or if the court holds here that it was appropriate, remand it back to the trial court for a factual determination as to the validity of Shelter's notice of the drop down coverage for the Shelter versus Mid-Century insurance case. Thank you.
Let me say just a couple of things about plaintiff's farmer's argument. I think it's made our point. Counsel argued that it was involuntary, but it wasn't. If we follow the procedure that I've suggested, which is consistent with Colorado law, all of the farmer's rights were protected. Involuntary suggests that there was no way to protect its rights. It had to make the payment. False. Its rights would have been protected if it had an offer to settle and told Shelter, and Shelter said, no, let's go to trial. Then Shelter became responsible for whatever the adverse results were above the $75,000. Farmers was protected. the issue of whether it was just or unjust. Under the farmer's scenario, one side or the other always loses. Shelter, in this situation, lost its rights to control and decide whether to take the case to settle. In our scenario, neither side loses its rights. If one side wants to go to trial or one side wants to settle, it is protected because the side that wants to go to trial and something adverse happens then becomes responsible for the adverse results. Windfall. Farmers argued that Shelter got a windfall because of farmer's unilateral payment. That was a voluntary payment. Under their theory, Shelter got a windfall. Under our theory, farmers would have gotten a windfall if we'd gotten a defense verdict. Farmers would have gotten the windfall of the defense verdict. This all comes back to...
Or if you would have lost, would they then be liable for the excess?
That's my proposal, is that they are not liable for the excess. It's similar to an insured and its insurer. If the insurer takes the gamble, the insurer becomes responsible for the result. And if it's a good result, great. But if it's an adverse result, the insurer that decided to take the gamble becomes responsible for it.
But no one raised this procedure at the time when it could have been, when it could have gone to trial. And so now we're looking back in hindsight and you're saying, well, we should have been allowed to go to trial and then...
Well, I don't know that it wasn't raised. There's nothing in the record to indicate what the discussions were when farmers made its unilateral payment. The only thing in the record is the letter from the attorney saying this is the range of possibilities.
For our purposes, though, if it's not raised on the record, in fact, it's not raised. We can't take that sort of a possibility into consideration if we don't know that it was presented at trial.
Well, I think you're right. I'm not saying that it was presented. I don't think we need to submit to you that it was presented. I'm saying this is the way the law should be applied. The law should be applied that farmers cannot make a unilateral decision and make a voluntary payment that then takes away the rights of Shelter, whether or not Shelter wanted to go to trial. Now, we know that Shelter did not want to participate in the settlement.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments. The case will stand submitted. Opinion will issue in due course.